see. They never wanted me. The curse is laid upon my race. Useless serpents, they bring disgrace. A man without a face. Time they pass again. It's so hard to tell where and when. Yeah, just do the best you can. The flames will burn away the waste. All the lies that they told erased. A man without face. A man without a 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 face.
Welcome, dear ladies and gentlemen, to the Rabbit Hole Radio Show with your host, David James. Welcome, kinswomen and kinsmen. Yes, we're finding all about Shem, aren't we? Now, as I've said, I don't agree with everything the way Eustace has put it in this book, but nevertheless, it's a great book. You know, we don't have to agree on everything with everybody, you know, in order to be together in this war. Some people believe different things. Some people haven't come to the full knowledge of the truth. You just have to realize that no matter who you are, we're not all in the same place in Jesus Christ. Some of us have searched deeper. Some of us have not come to the fullness of the knowledge. I mean, I don't know everything. I know that. However, my view of what I do seem to know is beyond Eustace in the sense of the biblical thing. However, you know, his knowledge of other things are beyond me. You know what I mean? We all have our strengths. And not everybody can be an expert on the Bible. I don't consider myself an expert on the Bible, and yet I love the word of Yahweh, and I consider myself pretty well-versed on it. But I still wouldn't say I'm an expert, and neither was Eustace. However, interestingly, he states, we're on page 17 here, and listen to this sentence, because it's almost like he knows that we are the true Israel of the Bible. I guess he does know it. It's just interesting. Just listen to this statement. The children of Israel, that is, the descendants of Shem, obeyed God and did war against the Canaanites. But in later generations, they lost sight of this goal, permitting the Canaanites to live with them. During this period of history, there were great victories against their historic enemy, as recounted in Judges 1:17. It says, "And Judah went with Simeon, his brother, and they slew the Canaanites that inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it," unquote. Yes, today we're snapping right into action here. We're getting right to it. Let's continue. This victory came about because the children of Israel were distraught, and they sought guidance from Yahweh. Judges 1, verses 1 through 5. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked Yahweh, saying, "Who shall go up for us against the Canaanites, first to fight against them?" And Yahweh said, "Judah shall go up." Behold, I have delivered the land into his hands. And Judah said unto Simeon his brother, come up with me into my lot, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And Judah went up, and Yahweh delivered the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hand. And they slew the Canaanites and Perizzites. Later the victors fell again into the evil practices of those whom they had conquered, and again they were punished by Yahweh. Judges 4, verses 1 and 2. The children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, and the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh sold them into the hands of Jabin, the king of the Canaanites. A later verse in Judges notes that the Israelites prevailed against Jabin and destroyed him and the Canaanites. Exodus 15:15 says, then shall the dukes of Edom be amazed, the mighty sons of Moab. Remember I told you how many dukes of Edom are there? 11. Hello. And he says, the sons of Moab, trembling shall take hold of them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. Nelson's concordance lists more than 85 biblical verses referring to the Canaanites. Most of the references are unfavorable, and invariably they reveal God's determination to punish his people for their misdeeds. Ezekiel 16:1-3. Quote, again, the words of Yahweh came to me. Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations. Your origin and your birth are of the land of Canaan. Considering the frequency of references to Canaanites in the Bible, it is surprising that religious leaders rarely make any mention of them. In fact, many of the wealthier religious leaders today are actively in league with the Canaanites, enabling them to garner millions of dollars in contributions from gullible Christians. Ain't that the truth? Certainly, the barbaric practices of the Canaanites were never secret, nor were they unknown in ancient times, as evidenced by the number of references available. Psalms 106, verse 37 and 38. They sacrificed their sons and daughters to the demon. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. Because of this well-documented record of their fiendish practices, God issued numerous orders that the tribe should not intermarry with this people. Isaac passed on one of these orders to Jacob. Genesis 28:1, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him, ye shall not marry one of the Canaanite women. See? I had this Jew pastor from Florida tell me, oh, Jacob married all Canaanite women. You see, these Jews are pathetic liars. Pathetic liars. So what did he just say here? What did Isaac say to Jacob? Now, if he said that to Esau, Esau didn't obey, but Jacob did, you see. So he said, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him, you shall not marry one of the Canaanite women. We have previously noted that Miriam and Jacob turned against Moses for marrying a Cushite or black. We already been through this. The men of old were aware of the necessity to protect their genetic heritage, and they were equally aware that it would vanish in a single generation if the wrong marriages took place. The prohibition against mingling with the demon-worshipping Canaanites remained one of God's strongest commands. Yahweh said, so shall we be separated, I and all of thy people, from all the people that are upon the face of the earth. Again, listen. You see what condition we're in today because of the Canaanite Jews? Right? Listen. God said, so shall we be separated, I and all of thy people, from all the people that are on the face of the earth. Exodus 3:16. Yahweh characterized the Canaanites thusly, and I will make them a terror and an evil for all the kingdoms of the earth, referring to the diaspora ED. As a reproach and a proverb, a taunt and a curse on all places where I shall scatter them. Jeremiah 24:9. Haven't I told you that they're a curse on any nation that they're in? You see? Jeremiah 24:9. Let's say it again. And I will make them a terror and an evil for all the kingdoms of the earth, as a reproach and a proverb, a taunt and a curse on all places where I shall scatter them. Speaking of the Canaanite Jews. It's incredible. Thus we see the Canaanites, newly named the Phoenicians, dispersing all along the trade routes and avenues of commerce throughout the earth. As Yahweh prophesied, they spread corruption, terror, and devastation wherever he scattereth them. Later known as the Phoenicians, they dominated the avenues of commerce. Then they settled inland. They specialized as merchants and later as bankers, at last comprising a group now loosely known as the Black Nobility, which holds seemingly irresistible power today. Yahweh further warned his people against the dispersed Canaanites, Deuteronomy 7, verses 2 through 5. Thou shalt smite them, utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with... Why is it saying, I hum? Such as the League of Nations or the United Nations, nor show any mercy to them. Now, you see, we do show mercy because we're of our Father, right? And they don't show any mercy because they're of their Father. So they take advantage of us for these reasons. Neither shalt thou make... there's something wrong with the text here. Marriage with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. And it's happening all over the world, isn't it? Aren't we doing exactly that? Aren't the Jews mixing with us? And everybody else too, but I'm just saying that, you know, this is forbidden. For they will turn away thy son from following thee, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of Yahweh be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. See? See what I'm talking about with the statues? This was a direct command to destroy the groves and shrines of the demon-worshipping mystery cults known as Freemasonry. The prohibition against graven images has been misunderstood by many well-meaning Christians. Oh, listen to this. God did not prohibit graven images. He prohibited the obscene images of Baal and Ashtaroth cults, which were made to create sexual excitement as part of their obscene rites. Really? The battle against obscenity goes on today, although it often seems that American Christians are losing it. Well, I disagree with you. We're just not supposed to worship images. Period. And this is what King Hezekiah did. He destroyed all those kinds of things. In making these demands, they were not requests. Yahweh was not offering a program for a school picnic. He was laying out the only program which he would allow his people to survive on this earth. However, or otherwise, he warned, and a mongrel race will dwell in Ashdod. Zechariah 9:6. Should his people fail to carry out his instructions, Yahweh specifically described what would happen, and in so doing, he accurately described the world of today. This is from Deuteronomy 28, verse 15 and 43 and 44. But it shall come to pass, if thou shalt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Listen very carefully. The stranger that is within thy gates, the Canaanites and their descendants, shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. That's exactly what's happened. You've heard that before. See what happens when you don't obey the Father? When we don't obey? Certainly, this is the situation which exists in the United States today. The Venetians control the Federal Reserve System. Again, communist reserve system. I told you federal means communist, or federalist means communist, or federalism, communism. That's what it is. They lend to us, but we do not lend to them. They are the head and we are the tail. Having become Satan's curse on humanity, the Canaanites now spread across the earth. You mean a curse on mankind. You see, I'm not going to, you realize there's a difference between humanity, colored man, the beast of the field, and mankind, which is Adam kind. So, having become Satan's curse on mankind, and humanity for that fact, for that matter, the Canaanites now spread across the earth like some evil plague. Genesis 10:18. The families of the Canaanites were spread abroad. This diaspora brought troubles to every nation in which this people landed. Are you listening? Ezekiel 16:3, 45, and 46 lists the racial tribes of the Canaanites, denouncing them individually. Thy father an Amorite, their mother an Hittite, their older sister Samaria, their younger sister Sodom. Let me stop right now. Jesus forbade the disciples from going to preach the gospel in Samaria. And yet we see that they went to Samaria, Philip, and so on and so forth, right? Because of the Apostle Paul. We see that things that were forbidden were done through trickery. Right? You see what he's saying right here? Thy father is an Amorite, thy mother a Hittite, their older sister Samaria, their younger sister Sodom. Jesus, the minister of compassion, when he was asked to cure a Canaanite, denounced them as dogs. Matthew 15:22. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and cried, have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely possessed by a demon. Now, let me stop right there. Remember what I said about haves and have-nots on the last News Bite show from earlier this morning, if you've heard it. See, the reason the have-nots have not is because they have no covenant with the Father in heaven, and they worship demons and false gods. No wonder her daughter was possessed by a demon, correct? But we are known as the haves because we have a covenant with the Father. So the reason why the have-nots have not are very obvious. You can't worship false gods and demons and have from the Father in heaven. It's just not going to happen. So, she said, have mercy on me. My daughter is severely possessed by a demon. But he did not answer her a word. At last he did answer her in verse 26, and he answered, it is not fair to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. By children, he meant the children of Israel. That's us, yes. And that the Canaanites were dogs. She persisted, and finally he did heal her daughter. I would think that in the future, her daughter became full of more demons anyway because of their practices, you see. The Canaanite political parties were the Pharisees, Sadducees, Zealots, Essenes, Assassins, Herodians, and Scribes. A later group, the Edomites, descended from Esau and later intermarried with the Turks, producing a Turco-Edomite mixture, which later became known as the Khazars. What did I tell you? You see, there it is now again, right? And you see that the Jews are trying to play a game where they say, well, 95% of Jewry are not real Jews. They're Jews from the Khazarian Empire who have converted to Judaism. But what does it just say right here? I told you what it said. And that, of course, the rest of that ploy by the Jews is that the other 5% are the real, the good Jews, the ones from the tribe of Judah. No, no Jews are from any tribe of Judah, whether they're from Khazaria or anywhere else. Now listen, the Canaanite political parties, he said all that, right? He said a later group, the Edomites, descended from Esau and later, listen, intermarried with the Turks, producing a Turco-Edomite mixture, which later became known as the Khazars, the present occupants of Israel, according to the great Jewish scholar Arthur Koestler. Turco-Mongolian. Isn't it funny how they've changed that to Turco-Mongolian? And what's his face here? Mr. Eustace Mullins says it's a Turco-Edomite mixture. See, somebody was trying to hide something there by calling it Turco-Mongolian, I think. We know that the Jews are Mongolian in a sense anyway, but think about that for a minute. That might just be the cover-up right there. Turco-Edomite instead of Turco-Mongolian. You think about that for a little while and what that really means. Somebody was trying to hide the Edomite blood. I told you that they were Edomites anyway. And that they are real Jews. The Khazarians are real Jews. Why did I tell you that throughout the different times? Is because in the German documentary, when they were migrating into Germany, there was not one farmer among them. And they were all merchants. And they didn't want to do any work. See? Let's continue. The Canaanites were divided into Amorites, Hittites, Moabites, Midianites, Philistines, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, Sepharvaims, Perizzites, and affiliated tribes, all of which are routinely denounced in the Bible. Genesis 3:17. The Perizzites are the enemies of God. The Ammonites worshipped Moloch, Chemos, and were demon-possessed. The Ashdodites worshipped the fish and the god. Fish and god Dagon. The fish head god. That's what it really is. They were robbers and hated God, as recorded in the British Museum. You listening? The Ashdodites worshipped the fish god Dagon and were robbers and they hated God. And this was recorded in the British Museum. The Egyptians were known as worshippers of black magic, which resulted in God's rebuff to Hagar. The Amorites were cursed by God in Ezra 9:1. Hittite was defined as meaning to destroy or terrify. Perizzite came to stand for strife or disorder. Sepharvaim, later Sephardim, Sephardic Jews, were revolutionaries. Jebusite stands for trampling underfoot. Oh, Zeppelin song, trampled underfoot. In his monumental work, The History of the Jews, Joseph Castine writes on page 19, the Canaanitish cults were closely connected with the soil and express the forces of nature and the expressive forces of nature, particularly the force of fertilization. The force of divinity was called Baal. Whenever any question arose involving their existence as a nation, they knew only one God and recognized but one idea, the theocracy. Of course, they worship fertilization, you get it? Like Bill Gates with his jar of fecal matter. Thus, Castine admits that the Canaanites were fertility cults. Of course, fertility also meaning, you know, fertilization. That's the way I put it. But you know what fertility is. You know, that's sex. Castine admits the Canaanites were fertility cults, but he does not explain that the worship of Baal as a god of fertility with the obscene rites of his queen, Ashtoreth, was so abominated in the ancient world that whenever Baal was used in this context in referring to proper names, the suffix for Baal was Bosheth or shameful. Thus we get the name Ishbosheth and Mephibosheth. Etc. The destructive nature of the Canaanites upon other nations in which they settled is nowhere more strongly demonstrated than in Egypt, the first land to be corrupted by their barbaric practices. Originally, Baal simply meant Lord in the Canaanite language. The obscenity of the rite soon developed a popular image of Baal, which had three heads, the head of a cat, the head of a man, and the head of a toad. His wife, Ashtoreth, also known as Astarte or Ishtar from Easter, right? The fertility goddess, right? The head of a man, yeah, right, okay. And so his wife, Ashtoreth, also known as Astarte or Ishtar, was the principal goddess of the Canaanites. She also represented the reproductive principle in nature. And in case of anyone that anyone might overlook it, all of her rites were sexual observances. In Babylon, the temples of Baal and Ashtoreth were usually together. Mainly, they served as houses of prostitution, in which the priestesses were prostitutes, and the male priests were sodomites, who were available for worshippers who were of that persuasion. Sounds like today, doesn't it? The worship of the Canaanite gods consisted of orgies, and all their temples were known as centers of vice. They also originated voodoo ceremonies, which became the rites of observance in Ethiopia through the Ethiopian Jethro, the tutor of Moses. Well, that's strange. These same rites now enthrall tourists in the Caribbean. See, I think he's got that wrong. I don't believe that's the Ethiopian Kush part. That's the other Kush that Bertrand Comparé talked about. There were two Kushes, and one was there, and that's where Jethro was. Really, his name, that Jethro is a title, a kingly title. But remember, we already just talked about this. See, the Kush that the blacks do this voodoo are in the middle of the continent of Africa. So anyway, it was not long before the simple ceremonies of vice began to pull on the worshippers of Baal to pull on. They sought greater excitement in the rites of human sacrifice and cannibalism. Remember? Cain and Baal, cannibalism, in which the torture and murder of small children were featured. To consolidate their power over the people, the priests of the Canaanites claimed that all the firstborn children were owed to their demon gods, and they were given over for sacrifice. This lewd and barbaric practice was noted in Isaiah 57, 3 through 5. But you, draw near hither, sons of the sorceress, offspring of the adulterer and the harlot. Of whom are you making sport? Against whom make ye a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? Are ye not children of transgression? Remember the Rolling Stones, how they'd show the tongue? Or you have the filthy, dirty Jew from Kiss sticking his tongue out from a wide mouth? Again, it says, against whom make ye a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? Are ye not children of transgression, a seed of falsehood, inflaming yourself with idols under every green tree, slaying the children in the valleys under the clefts of the rocks? Thus Isaiah inveighed not only against the obscene expressions of the blood-maddened orgiasts, their salacious grimaces, but also their now well-established custom of practicing their horrible rites in groves and shrines. Groves and Shriners. You know the Shriners with the burn center? Get it? Where they could murder children without being seen and punished by the descendants of Shem. King Solomon came under the influence of the child murderers, and he rebuilt an altar to Milcom or Molech from the Hebrew Melech, meaning king. 1 Kings 11:5 through 8, Molech or Moloch was honored by his worshippers by the building of a great fire on his altar. The parents were then forced by the priest to throw their children into the fire. In excavations at Giza, the pharaoh Merneptah called himself the Binder of Giza after he put a stop to the obscene rites of the Canaanites at Giza. Malacaster, under the auspices of the Palestine Exploration Fund from 1904 to 1909, found in the Canaanite stratum of about 1500 BC, the ruins of a high place, quote-unquote, a temple to Ashtoreth, containing 10 crude stone pillars, 5 to 11 feet high, before which human sacrifices were offered. Under the debris in this high place, quote-unquote, allegedly, right? In other words, it's not a high place at all. McAllister found great numbers of jars containing the remains of children who had been sacrificed to Baal. Another horrible practice was that they called what they called the foundation sacrifice. When a house was to be built, a child would be sacrificed and its body would be built into the wall to bring good luck to the rest of the family. Many of these were found in Gezer. They have been found also in Megiddo, Jericho, and other places. That's from Halley's Bible Handbook. Halley also notes that in this so-called high place, McAllister found large piles of images and plaques of Ashtoreth with rudely exaggerated sex organs designed to stimulate sexual acts. Ashtoreth images found in many areas of the Canaanite influence emphasize oversized breasts, sensuous smiles, heavily accented eyes, and nudity. The demonic nature of this sex worship is traced directly to Ham's intercourse with the witch Naamah on the ark. Colonel Garnier, in his Worship of the Dead, writes, "Naamah was celebrated for her beauty, talent, energy, lustfulness, and cruelty, and she was of the Nephilim parentage." In other words, she was one of the fallen angels, one of the sons of God and daughters of men, horrible unions produce. Lovely, isn't it? It's a lovely world we live in, don't you think? Despite their prominence, now let me just stop there before I even start this. We see that we have Pizzagate. We see that there's children being kidnapped every year in all of our countries. These things, these sacrifices to Baal, have never stopped, ladies and gentlemen. That's what the whole thing's all about. It's not like this was some horrible past that happened, and thank God we came to our senses and stopped all this. This is still going on to this very minute. Remember the Rite of the Ninth Circle that the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury participated in and have done on probably many occasions? What is the Pope but a Canaanite priest anyway? He's a Jew. And the Catholic religion is Babylonian. So, of course, it's just Canaanite crap. The Encyclopedia Judaica, The Encyclopedia Judaica describes the Canaanite demonology as featuring Lilith, the vampire, Resef, the god of the plague. The god of COVID-19, only COVID-19's not real. Dever, the god of pestilence, and the god of the underworld, Mot, from Mavet, and which is the Hebrew word for death, Mavet, M-A-V-E-T. Despite their prominence as destructive influences in the ancient world, the Canaanites and their demon god Baal seldom appear in the authoritative works of the ancient Near East. Gaston Maspero's Great History of Egypt, The Dawn of Civilization, published in 1894 and republished in 1968, does not mention either Baal or Canaan. H.R. Hall's Ancient History of the Near East does not mention Shem or Canaan in the index. Baal has a single mention. How much of this is due to the deliberate falsification and destruction of historical records by the Egyptian priesthood cannot be ascertained, but the results are obvious. Another contributing factor is the sudden disappearance of the names Canaan and Canaanites from all historical records after 1200 BC. How did this come about? It was very simple. They merely changed their name. You see, ladies and gentlemen, see how many things are being testified to? I've told you many of these things that once they get caught under something, they just change the name and continue what they're doing. So they don't use the word Canaanites anymore. But you see that what I've been talking about that's been happening all over the world is people are kneeling to Baal. People are showing their unity to the dark side, to Baal, to the goats. You know what I'm saying? They've been showing Baal all over the world and Moloch and everything else. You see, Baal's still here. And this Baal worship is being shown right to your face all over the world. Justin Trudeau bent his knee. The cops bent their knee. The military bent their knee. The politicians bent their knee. You know, on and on and on it goes. Who do you think they're kneeling to? They're not kneeling to the Father in heaven. I'm telling you who they're kneeling to and nailing to. Chambers' Encyclopedia notes that after 1200 BC, the name of the Canaanites vanished from history. They changed their name to Phoenician. Thus, the most notorious and most hated people on earth received a new lease on life. The barbaric Canaanites had disappeared. The more civilized Phoenicians, seemingly harmless merchant folk, took their place, having obtained a monopoly on purple dye, which was a highly prized item throughout the ancient world. The Canaanites advertised their control over this product by calling themselves Phoenicians, from Phoenicia or Phoenicia, the Greek word for purple. From the outset of their history, the Phoenician Canaanites always managed to get a monopoly on some essential product. They later had a monopoly on tin for some centuries, until Greeks discovered tin in Cornwall in 233 BC. Joseph of Arimathea, the uncle of Jesus, was said to have owned large tin mines in Cornwall. The change of the name did not mean that the Canaanites had abandoned their worship of Baal and Ashtoreth. They became more prudent in their worship of Baal, and in the colonies which they established along the length of the Mediterranean, they built their temples to the female of the species, Ashtoreth. In the Egyptian city of Memphis, the Phoenician temple of Ashtoreth was the largest religious edifice. She was known there as the wife of the supreme god El and his 70 deities. In their rituals, Ashtoreth was sometimes worshipped as the male demon Ashtaroth, who survived in European rites as Astara or Ostara. In this form, he became the patron god of the Nazi movement in Germany. The westernmost output of the Phoenicians was Cadiz. It's funny how we always have to base everything back to Nazi. You know, it's kind of, you know, Fritzy Springmeier-y. You know what I mean? Meier-y. The westernmost output of the Phoenicians was Cadiz, a Phoenician colony which derived its name from the Semitic Gadir, or fortress. Their most important colony, which soon became a rival to Rome itself, was Carthage, which they established around 900 BC. The name derived from Hebrew, Kart Hashat, or a new city. The Phoenicians often named their cities with the prefix of new, like New Amsterdam, or New York, or New Jersey, you see, or New Mexico. During the 5th century, the Carthaginians had fought the Greeks and had survived. But in 264 BC, Rome attacked in full force. A series of wars ensued called the Punic Wars, because the Carthaginians called themselves the Punics. St. Augustine noted that the Punics among themselves referred to their people as the Canaani or Canaanites. But this name was like a secret code. They had never used it in dealing with other people. Don't you find that interesting? Canaani, like China too, you know what I mean? Whether for purely commercial reasons or because they feared a military power astride their avenues of commerce in the Mediterranean, the Romans determined to utterly destroy Carthage. They succeeded in this resolve so absolutely that present-day archaeologists are not sure where Carthage was located. From 264 to 201 BC, Rome waged three Punic wars against Carthage, culminating in defeat of their leader, Hannibal.
Ah.
The Silence of the Lambs. Huh? Hannibal? You know, the same guy that played the Apostle Paul? By the Roman armies, under the command of Scipio Africanus, the Romans killed or took into slavery every Carthaginian and razed the city. They completed their task by sowing the land with salt so that nothing would ever flourish there again. Nothing ever did. Well, how would we know that if we don't know where it is? This defeat, although a major setback, did not destroy the world operation of the Canaanites, but it did inculcate in them a fierce hatred of all things Roman, which ever since has been characterized by the Canaanite school of propaganda as fascism, from the Roman rods, or fasces. They were carried by the magistrate to symbolize his determination. To maintain order, that says. There's some typo things, weird things going on here. The later Masonic assault upon the Catholic Church was largely dictated by the fact that it was headquartered in the city of their most ancient enemy, Rome. And therefore, the papacy became to the Phoenicians the modern embodiment of the force which had destroyed their most important headquarters. Few Americans realize that when the New School of Research in New York denounces fascism, joined by the columnists of the New York Times and the New York Compost, they are merely echoing their ancient anger over the destruction of Carthage. Here again, our historians have only one goal, to obscure the past and to prevent us from realizing the nature of the forces at work. What do you think about this so far? Isn't that interesting? So they keep changing their names. They were the Canaanites. Then they were the Phoenicians. Then they were the Venetians. Then they were the black nobility. And now they're the Jews. Very interesting, isn't it? That was me speaking. That's not written in the book here. So let's continue. It was not only the Canaanites who spread across the earth. The descendants of Shem also multiplied and journeyed to find greater opportunities for their families. They moved from country to country, founding great kingdoms and dynasties, which have survived to the present day. There are many people who can argue that the kings and leaders of the Western nations are descended from the tribe of Judah, but they fail to recognize one important fact, which is entirely omitted by the King James Version of the Bible, that there were three branches of the tribe of Judah. Listen carefully. Those who lump all the descendants of the tribe of Judah together do not realize there was a tainted branch. There were the families of Phares and Zerah, Judah's purebred sons, out of Tamar. And there was a third branch, Judah's descendants from a Canaanite mother, Shua, who were known ever afterwards as the cursed Shelonites. Tamar was the daughter of Aram, the youngest son of Shem. Shua called Tamar's sons bastards because they had been born out of wedlock, while the twins claimed to be the rightful heirs of Judah because they were of pure-blooded stock, the Adamite strain. From the Shelonites descended 31 cursed tribes of Canaanites, of Judea, and Samaria, including Sepharvaims, a name which the Canaanites had adopted for their deceptive purposes. Very, very interesting what's being said here, ladies and gentlemen. At the birth of Phares and Zerah, the midwife, seeing that there were twins in the womb, realized that it would be necessary to mark the firstborn who would have the primogeniture. She quickly wrapped the red thread around the wrist of Zerah, but it was Phares who came out first from the breach. The Messiah was descended from Phares, and he was said to have been sent by God to heal the breach, which had existed since the birth of Phares and Zarah. Tamar, the mother of Phares and Zarah, had a descendant named Tamar Tephi, known in Irish legend as the daughter of Pharaoh. She married Eochaid, king of Ireland, who was known as the Prince of the Scarlet Thread. Thus, the two lines of Phares and Zarah were again reunited. The Scarlet Thread subsequently became an integral part of British history. A red thread is symbolically woven into every rope, which is used by the Royal Navy, and every British monarch has delivered him official documents which are wrapped with a red cord. The term also survives in red tape, quote-unquote. That is, the official red cord which must be unwound for any state business to be transacted. There is also a red carpet which tradition required to be rolled before royalty walks in. Isn't this interesting? Because the Jews have taken that red thread and used it for Kabbalist Jews. See, they're not of us. They have nothing to do with us. Yet they want to keep trying to thread themselves in. Before he would give Tamar in marriage, Heraman, the father of Tamar, demanded that serpent worship and the rites of Bel, that's Baal too, right, which were then practiced in Ireland, be renounced. The serpents then disappeared from Ireland, and there were no poisonous serpents, and there are no poisonous serpents there today. A later legend is that St. Patrick expelled all the serpents from Ireland. Both legends call attention to the demonic practices of the Canaanites, as well as their descendant from the serpent. Its banishment established Ireland as the land of true religion of Yahweh, or the descendants of Shem. Did you hear that? Its banishment of the serpent established Ireland as a land of the true religion of Yahweh, or the descendants of Shem. The disappearance of the serpents also signified that evil powers of the Canaanites had vanished from Ireland. Well, they're back now, aren't they? Both Spain and Ireland show their direct connection to the descendants of Shem in their names. Spain occupies the Iberian Peninsula from Eber or Hebrew. Ireland is known as Hibernia, the land of the Hebrews, and are the Hebrides Islands. The History of Ireland, Roger Chauvin says, that Ireland is the remaining past of Atlantis, which is still above the surface of the sea. In his History of Ireland, A.M. Sullivan writes of the legendary origin of the present Irish race. The Milesian colony reached Ireland from Spain, but they were not Spanish. They were an Eastern people who had tarried in that country on their way westward, seeking the aid an island promised to the prosperity of their ancestors, Gadelius. Gadelius was the son of Nyul, who was the son of the king of Scythia. As a child, Gadelius had been bitten by a poisonous serpent. He was near death when his father persuaded Moses to use his rod to cure him. From that day, Milesians carried westward their banner, which was emblazoned with a dead serpent and the rod of Moses, which they found an island which had no poisonous snakes until they found one. The sons of Milesius, Cadelius's descendants, who sailed from Spain to Ireland, were Heber the Fair, Amerigen Copa, Heber the Brown, IR, and Heramon. Their descendants ruled Ireland for 1,000 years, the dynasty being established by Niall or Nial, who ruled at Tara from 310 to 405. He is described by Sullivan as a splendid hero of Gaelic blood, tall, fair-haired, and blue-eyed, a great and noble-minded warrior, kind in Hall and fierce in fray. From him descended the kings of Ireland, the Niels. These conquerors of Ireland, the Milesians, derive their name from Milesius, the soldier from Latin miles, which we get the word militia. Gadelius, the founder of the line, derived his name from the Hebrew Gadil, meaning to become great, or in plural, the exalted and fortune seekers and fortunate ones. Because of their great pride and natural abilities, the Irish were later referred to as being from the land of kings, quote unquote. Of almost any Irishman, it could be boastfully said, sure, he is the descendant of kings. From earliest records, the Irish and the Britons are known to be historic enemies. Apuleius wrote in 296 AD of the two races, the Britons and Hibernia. Eumenius always wrote of Hibernia as the enemy of Britain. Caesar's notes on the Gallic Wars 58 to 50 BC wrote of Hibernia west of Britain. The world was now swept. This is very interesting. The world was now swept by two diametrically opposed tides of history. On one hand, there were the highly creative and productive descendants of Shem, who have since become known as Semites. Right? You see what I've been telling you? Not that a lot of you didn't know that already, but there are people that didn't know that. They think Jews are Semites. Jews aren't Semites. So, on the one hand, were the highly creative, productive descendants of Shem, who have since become known as Semites, and on the opposing side were the cursed Canaanites, who historically were the anti-Semites. Are you listening? You see, what these Jews are doing is what I was telling you, that anti-Semite means white. Now, I'm not using that term to ingratiate them. I don't use that term. I use the term anti-Jewite. But you see, they have tried to turn everything around. They call us Amalekites, and they call us anti-whites, anti-Semites. And they're pretending that they are the Semitic Anglo-Saxon people or whatever. They are the true Israel of the Bible, you see. And by calling us anti-Semites, that means we would hate our own people, because anti-Semite means anti-white. You see what I'm trying to say to you? That's why I don't use the term anymore. Because if you use the term, you're helping the Jews to pull a game on us. So, listen again. You have these diametrically opposed sides on history. One hand were the highly creative and productive descendants of Shem, who have since been known as the Semites, and on the opposing side were the cursed Canaanites, who historically were the anti-Semites, the foes of the tall, fair-haired, and blue-eyed descendants of Shem. Because the Semites were always known as great warriors, they handedly defeated the Canaanites in every military encounter, and in many cases obeyed Yahweh's command to drive them out and destroy them utterly. But the anti-Semites, which are the Jews, seem to have great staying power. When driven out of one country, they appeared in another to continue their same type of corruption and betrayal. While the Semites, the whites, Shemites, were busily establishing one great empire after another, Ashur's building the Assyrian Empire, Cyrus the Great building of the Persian Empire, and Shem himself creating the great Egyptian civilization, and anti-Semites, Jews, Canaanites, were developing their own talents. These included a talent for trade and commerce, for travel, for making themselves at home in any country, the internationalists, you see, and among any race of people, because they have to mix with us, you see. All of it is, we're connecting these dots again and again and again and again, and it all fits perfectly, doesn't it? See, B.F. Jackson's book, he died and his family, even though he was a Freemason, and I don't agree with that, he died to bring that information to us and his family. You know it's true. So, Generally, they establish their trading colonies along the sea coasts, for they lack the courage to venture into the great wildernesses of Europe, where the whites always, or Shemites, always made themselves at home. The Canaanites always remained true to the precepts of the will of Canaan. They were true to each other, regardless of the circumstances. They were constant in their love of robbery, their love of lewdness, their hatred of the masters, that is, anyone who tried to interfere with their corrupt way of life. And they always refused to tell the truth. By remaining loyal to these unchanged precepts, the anti-Shemites had their, in other words, they hate white people. The Jews hate white people. They are the anti-Shemites or Semites. Had their at their disposal vital weapons for their war against the people of Shem. The Shemites, on the other hand, being fiercely individualistic, never hesitated to pit their empires against each other, or even family against family, their overweening pride always taking precedence before any racial or historical imperative. Yeah, that's to our detriment for sure. During the Middle Ages, the people of Shem found their typical characteristics best expressed in such organizations as the Teutonic Knights, a group of warriors which was invincible for hundreds of years. At the same time, the anti-Semites, the Canaanite Jews, were busily expanding trade routes and amassing their profits from trade. To this day, the British aristocracy professes disdain for anyone who sullies his hands with trade, an ancient prejudice against the Canaanites. With these profits, they eventually became bankers to the world. In pursuing this objective, they found a great opportunity during the Crusades. Not only did the Crusades open up trade routes throughout the known world, but they also opened up new avenues of graft and corruption, which allowed the Canaanites to amass even greater profits. When the Christian knights departed from the Crusades, dedicating themselves to the service of Christ, the Canaanites, who prudently remained at home, now perfected various schemes to rob the knights of their money and property while they were away. In ancient, we see that with Robin Hood, didn't we? Right? I'm not talking that Robin Hood was robbing. I'm saying that the people that were there while the knights were away were stealing their palaces and their lands and their people and everything. Right? You see? So when the Christian knights departed for the Crusades, dedicating themselves to the service of Christ, the Canaanites, who prudently remained at home, now perfected various schemes to rob the knights of their money and property while they were away. In ancient knighthood in the Crusades, we find that some of the Crusaders found shelter and protection at the hands of the Teutonic Knights, who were engaged in looking up the frauds perpetrated by rapacious monks and clergy, who had forged title deeds, I hope you're listening, and mortgage upon lands and property of absent Crusaders, or those who had fallen in defense of the cross in the Holy Land. Time for reflection and study of the causes of the Crusades at home and abroad, when other than the scum of Europe, which settled upon its dregs, the best people had been almost entirely obliterated from the face of the continent, and is still going on today, isn't it? The most mighty of men as well, right? The rapacity of the popes and the clergy down to the lowest monks was appalling to those self-sacrificing stalwart warriors of the cross who had returned and found utter strangers in the palaces or places and homes of their kindred. Tad upon investigation, it was discovered that frauds, forgeries of title deeds, and confiscations under pretexts of heresy had despoiled their kindred, and the meager few who had survived were beggars upon the highway and lanes, perishing as tramps by the wayside. Are you listening? We're going to stop right there on page 25. You see that we've always been taken advantage of and been cheated upon, ladies and gentlemen. And boy, Judgment Day is not going to be a happy day for many, many people. I I guess, you know, no matter what age you lived in, the same garbage was going on. As long as you have the curse of the nigger and the Jew, your nation will be cursed. And so will we. You know, our nation will be cursed and so will we. Obviously, it is that way. May the Father come soon. I know many of our brothers and sisters feel that way. You know, I give a little piece of advice at the end of the Rabbit Hole radio show, and that is, don't go down the wrong hole.
They bring disgrace. A man without a face. The sands of time, they pass again. It's so hard to tell where and when. Yet just do the best you can. Lines that they told erased. A man without a face. A man without a face. A man without a face. A man without.